Hello everyone, it's April 30th, 2024. This week, Voyager 1 is back to making sense. We'll discuss that. Then it's on to an ESA debris removal mission that was struck by debris. Go figure. Then we talk to Jeff Williams of Exum Instruments, a company that's going to put a mass spectrometer on the ISS. Big show, so let's go and lift off. In news for the tower, welcome to episode 457 of the Global Mechanics Podcast. I'm David.
I'm Ben.
And I'm Dennis.
All right, so I'm back. So last week, I took a trip to go see a concert in Florida.
Flaming Lips, right?
Yeah, the great Flaming Lips. And but one other thing I got to do was go to the what's called Neutral Zone Studios in Kingsland, Georgia. And that's just on the Florida-Georgia line there. And I went with a friend of mine, the same one that I went to the concert with, who's a sci-fi fan. And yeah, it was pretty interesting. So I got to see the set where they filmed all of the Star Trek Continues. I should know this, but I don't remember. Huh. But do you remember those Star Trek episodes that I think were posted to YouTube? I mean, you can still watch them. They were basically, I guess, like an unofficial remake of the original series.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
I think I first found out about it when I had heard that Grant Imahara had played Sulu on the show, and he had actually helped build some of the sets and so forth. And that was pretty interesting. The sets look interesting. They look, I mean, in person, very much like wood, because that's what they are. Mm-hmm. I mean, they still look cool when you take pictures, because I took a bunch of pictures, and yeah, they look nice.
So is it on like a studio lot, or is it just like a maker space or something where they just like set the stuff up and are still maintaining it?
The actual building looks like a warehouse, and I'm pretty sure that's what it was, and it's been turned into a studio.
I mean, like, did they film other shows there?
I don't think so, no. And in fact, I think they're currently raising money to keep that space there, although I don't know what they're going to do with it. They haven't made, I mean, they might make some more episodes. They haven't done so in a number of years. But yeah, it's just this big warehouse.
Holy moly. These sets are just gorgeous. I mean, like, they're a little run down. There are a couple of corners that are, you know, starting to pull away from each other. But like, those primary colors, man, they knew how to design spaceships back then.
Voyager is communicative. Cool. All right. So it's back. Yeah. So apparently it's not like incoherent. It was for some time, but we understand why. And measures have been taken to correct that.
Yeah. So I ran across a news article this week and I threw it into the show notes, you know, like on Monday or something. I was like, oh, yeah, I'm looking forward to digging into this later. And a listener wrote in, Milo, said, hey, you should talk about them getting Voyager 1 back online. And I'm just like, yeah, I know. Like, I really want to. And I was really excited. And when I finally got some time to go dig into this article, I was really excited initially because it was written with a fair amount of detail. And the article felt like a post on one of the NASA blogs. And so I was like, well, if a third party is writing this level of detail, there's got to be more detail on the NASA blogs. Like, I can probably go find some more information. Turns out, no, they copied and pasted straight out of blogs.nasa.gov. And so that was all the information. So basically, I have one post on the NASA blogs that is new. And the one post back is the one that I did a short and sweet on maybe like 4 or 5 episodes ago. So not actually that much information. I'm just champing at the bit. So last time we talked about how the FDS, the flight data subsystem, had been identified as the thing that had an issue. And the way they figured that out was by sending a poke, which asks the vehicle to dump its memory, in a signal back to Earth so you can read all of its memory. When they did that, it was garbled. It wasn't a repeating loop of ones and zeros, but it wasn't recognizable as information. And somebody wound up figuring out that, hey, we can actually decode this. It's, you know, it's garbled, but we can degarble it. And when they did that, they were able to identify that the FDS basically had a bad memory sector. And it turns out that it's actually just one chip on the FDS's memory array. If Voyager is anything like other vehicles, especially at the time, the memory card is just a bunch of chips on one board that like plugs in. And, you know, to be fair, they have 3 different computers, so they have 3 different memory banks that store program information. And this is just one of them, and just one of the one of the chips went bad. And it looks like it's really bad. Like, A, it's unrecoverable, and B, it sounds like the information that was on there is probably scrambled to the point where even though you can't overwrite it, maybe you could do some tweaks to other parts of the code and make things work. But it sounds like every functional piece of programming on there is ruined in one way or another. So we don't know if this is due to radiation damage or if it's just, you know, normal end of life failure kind of stuff. Remember, it's been in space for 46 years. So like we can forgive that, but we got a whole chip that we need to rewrite everything because we can no longer use this one chip. Basically anything that references the code there will need to get changed. And, you know, as expected, there's not enough free space to just copy and paste that block of programming somewhere else. They're actually going to have to split it up and fit it in wherever they can, and then make sure that each of those pieces are referencing the new location of whatever they're referencing, and that all the other code is now referencing these new locations. It's a pretty big job to make sure that you get it right the first time. And like, we don't really know what code is on there, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were some fun tricks that they use to optimize the code that no longer work when it's all split up, right? Like you could, instead of having the program wait for a certain number of cycles for a process to complete, you could just tell it to go execute a different task that takes the amount of time that you think it's going to. And there are a bunch of really cool little tricks like that that are used when you're so cautious about staying within the bounds of the resources that you have. And so, you know, it's not a spinning disk. So I wouldn't think that moving from one location to another in code would take different amounts of time. But, you know, there could be a case where you read a value and then add, you know, 10 to it and then jump to that location in memory and execute the code there. Like there could be something like that they have to go figure out. These are the questions that I need answers to. So just splitting it up and changing all the references is unlikely to be the only thing that they have to do. By the way, I don't know, David and Dennis, if you guys know this, but I mentioned spinning disks because one of the tricks that you could do is if you had a program running on a disk drive, you could actually count on the fact that there was inertia on that disk. And so when you move to a different location on the disk, you could count on the amount of time it took to move. You could count on the amount of time it took to spin up the disk or to get from 0 degrees on the disk to 180. And I've heard of some really cool tricks where they would actually like rely on the momentum of the disk to skip past parts of code. Not that the disk wasn't reading them when it should. It was just like they could skip from one place to another and affect the amount of time it took to do that.
So you're not mechanically, at some point you'd stop mechanically spinning it and just let
it would always be spinning because like,
but actively pushing it versus relying on its angular momentum.
Yeah, exactly. Like the firmware already controls all of that, at least by the time that the systems that I'm familiar with, the hardware controller chips on the drive will handle that, or your firmware will handle it. And the software that you're writing doesn't really get to alter that. But knowing that it was a spinning disk, moving to different places on that disk would take different amounts of time. And so if you were trying to jump only a couple of places over, you might actually have to wait for the whole disk to come all the way around. And so you'd actually put them in reverse order, you know, because you're going to have to do that anyway, you know, stuff like that. I'm being as vague in my descriptions as I can because I don't remember the details very well. That kind of thing. So anyway, you know, we'll see what it actually takes to split this code up and find new places for it. But the news this week, I believe it's on the 22nd of April, they got their first good engineering data back from the vehicle. The first thing that they decided to do was this one chip, very unfortunately, includes the code that's used to package up the engineering data from the vehicle. And that was the section that they focused on first. So they took that, split it up, found new places for it, sent an update to the vehicle. And when the vehicle had that update, Now it can send home understandable engineering data. So saying, you know, here's my battery levels, here's the state of the vehicle, and they're now getting that data back successfully. This is the first time in 5 months that we've been able to get that kind of engineering data back from the vehicle. The communication first stopped working back on November 14th. So we're looking at a full 5 months and a couple of days where they haven't heard anything from the vehicle that wasn't gibberish or a memory dump. Very, very exciting. So next, they're going to start working on the science data packaging so that Voyager 1 can start doing its science again, and we can get, you know, our good twin science probe comparisons back. I guess they probably don't do that much comparison because they're on different trajectories, but we'll have two working Voyagers again. Very exciting.
And this might be too obvious to state, but I guess then would this be the type of failure then you wouldn't expect to eventually crop up on Voyager 2? Like the odds of it are probably low, or is it unclear? Because when you say normal end of life failure, does that include like maybe this is just a known issue for designing a spacecraft like this type after, you know, 40 yeah. some years or whatever might happen to Voyager 2?
I mean, you know, anything could happen. I don't know if I think if we were to have a second failure like this, then yes, definitely you would expect it to start happening all over the memory. Hmm. But, you know, like it could be, you know, one manufacturing flaw in this one chip and nothing else is, you know, this particularly vulnerable to this failure mode. But the fact that they don't even know what kind of failure mode we're looking at, I have no idea if we should expect this to happen again.
The one article that you refer to says that the team doesn't know and that they think it could have been struck by a high energy particle or it could have just simply worn out. So I guess they wear out, which is interesting because these, I mean, I don't know what this physical like memory looks like, but it doesn't have any moving parts, right? At least I would assume so.
No, it's almost certainly like the DIP package that you're familiar with, like a black rectangle with bug legs coming off the sides. Yeah, no moving parts, but that doesn't mean that it can't fail over time. You know, it's still bounded by the restrictions of entropy. And, you know, you do have energy flowing through these circuits, and it's probably fairly high voltage compared to modern systems. Like, there's no way this is, like, you know, 3.3 volts. It just fails, especially if you're using it constantly and flowing electrons through it. It's going to fail at some point.
So let's translate over to our next topic a little bit closer to Earth, actually a lot closer to Earth. This one, ESA debris removal mission. This is interesting. So basically we have a spacecraft that was supposed to remove some, not like actual debris, but was supposed to, you know, perform certain maneuvers, but that other object was actually struck by debris. So it can't do its debris removal mission, or at least the original one. I think I got that right. Is that right, Dennis?
Yeah. Right. I mean, talk about trying to really make it clear that debris is an issue for spacecraft on orbit.
Yeah. This actually is a great, if not ironic, I guess it's ironic, right? I'm not sure, but
ironic in the colloquial sense or whatever. Yeah. Right? It's not. Yeah. This one, I can't remember us ever talking about on the show, but it's a really cool and interesting looking mission. It's ESA. It's their Clear Space 1 mission, and they contracted with a Swiss company named Clear Space to do it. And the idea, like you said, was to go and rendezvous with a piece of, you know, something orbiting in LEO and basically do it as a demo for debris removal. And but it wasn't going to do it in a very boring way. It literally has four very spidery looking like arms. Like they look like kind of like, I don't know, thin mandibles of like an insect maybe that are going to go and clamp down on something.
It looks like the mining ship from Escape Velocity Nova. I know that's a very...
I will take you at your word.
I'm going to find a photo of it, but I know that's a very obscure reference, but instant recognition to me.
And so, that original target was a Vega payload adapter called VESPA, which stands for Vega Secondary Payload Adapter. And these are pretty big, right? Vega is kind of not the most massive, you know, payload to orbit. And so these are, you know, just judging by people walk nearby, it looks like they're maybe, you know, two humans in length, you know, maybe about a human and a half in diameter. And so, right, this, of course, is what actually is holding your payload down while it's sitting in its fairing or shroud. And it turns out that it wasn't like they knew that this, like people watching from the ground saw that this adapter was going to likely get struck. This particular one was from a 2013 Vega launch. But just last year, they were, you know, tracking it from the ground like we do, and noticed that a whole bunch of new pieces suddenly appeared at that same location in orbit with very kind of similar, you know, orbital trajectories. And so evidently it had been struck by something. And so what makes this, what's, you know, the news now is, I guess, in the meantime, ClearSpace was kind of thinking, and ESA, of, you know, what are we going to do? We don't really want to approach this and do rendezvous and proximity operations when there's a cloud potentially of debris around it. And so we need to find a new target, and that's this news. And by the way, Ben is spot on about this. Does look like an asteroid miner from Escape Velocity Nova.
Yep.
And so the new target is going even further in the past. In 2001, there was a series of these Proba spacecraft that ESA had launched. Right, obviously they want to go after their own, you know, spacecraft in orbit. And so these are Earth observation ones, and these do not look like a, you know, a payload attached fitting. They have a rectangular shape. They're still pretty big in size, but I think that's pretty interesting that you've got something with a definitely a different shape, but they're still going to be like, all right, we're still going to do our demo on it. And that demo is you, it's more, I guess, ambitious than what, is it iSpace or Astroscale? One of the Japanese companies that's doing one of these.
Astroscale has done a recent debris capture, which is really cool.
Okay, yeah. Where they like they bring along their own client satellite and they kind of were doing a little dance with them. Ah, yes. And now they're just approaching and just checking out a piece of dead, you know, a dead part of a rocket.
Yeah, so that's the Address J mission, which I believe we've talked about.
But ClearSpace One is just going to straight up grapple with its new target, Proba 1, grab it in those four spidery arms, and then perform a perigee decrease maneuver and basically take it out of orbit and hopefully burn up safely in the atmosphere. Kind of taking the demo all the way through completion in just kind of one go, which I think is pretty awesome because I kind of want to see more of this sooner rather than later.
So did they abort from the Vespa target because there wasn't enough to grab onto or because there was too much loose debris in the area? Do you know why they made that decision?
That's a good question. I didn't see that stated one way or the other. It's funny. My brain immediately went to that it probably, because what hit it was small enough to not be detected, my guess is that it probably just like punctured or maybe tore off a few little pieces that were big enough to be detected. I don't think it like, you know, cut it in half or, you know, cut off an appreciable chunk of the vehicle so that it overall became too small. That's just me trying to guess at what a small piece of debris could do to a bigger object. It could break off maybe, you know, centimeter large and larger size pieces of it, but not take off, you know, cubic feet worth of.
Yeah. So this is interesting. So I found a statement. They actually did a technical and programmatic review with ESA after that debris strike. And the debris target was altered to adjust the requirements for the mission and simplify the structure of its industrial team and to reduce risks. So I guess there's probably a little bit of risk in there. It's interesting, the structure of its industrial team. So maybe they were going to have too many people working on too many different problems if they went and did that. And they'd rather have something that matches the drawings. I think that might be the right way to interpret that.
Thanks for catching that. Yeah, and I guess just to cap things up, you know, the plan is to launch this in 2026 on a Vega C. So we, you know, it's not up there now. Like, I wasn't making like a decision, you know, while I was already on orbit. Obviously, changing orbits would be very likely too fuel intensive and difficult. But yeah, in 2026, there is when they're going to launch and then hopefully go for this Proba 1 target. But yeah. That's a pretty exciting mission to keep an eye out for.
Yeah, let's just hope that this new target doesn't get struck by debris as well. That would be
no guarantees.
Yeah,
that really is the first echoes of Kessler syndrome coming at you. Mm. Like when you start trying to solve the problem and you can't.
All right, so let's just do two short and sweets this week. Ben, what is our first?
All right, China releases a lunar landing update. Chinese officials have confirmed that China is on track for a crewed landing before 2030, reporting that program development for the Long March 10 that will carry the crew and equipment to the moon is complete. The Kerolox engine that will power the rocket is currently undergoing hot fire testing. In addition, the Mengzhou crew spacecraft, the Lanyue lunar lander, and the landing suits have now moved to the prototype production and test phase. New launch facilities and infrastructure needed for the launch are also being built near the existing Wenchang Coastal Spaceport.
Next, TESS enters safe mode. Again, for the second time this month, NASA's Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, or TESS, has entered safe mode, suspending science operations. Analysis of what caused the first anomaly is still ongoing, as well as whether both causes for entering safe mode are connected. NASA says that the spacecraft remains stable and in good health, even as it recently celebrated its 6th anniversary in orbit.
Okay, stand by. We're looking at it.
Questions, comments, and correction, Burns, and we have a couple of, well, and clarifications. So this is regarding last week's Twissif about Sophia, or is it Sophia? I don't remember, but...
I say Sophia, I don't know.
It depends on which side of the Atlantic you're on.
Yeah. So Dennis O, the other Dennis, happened at... One of our listeners happens to be or used to be a software engineer for Sophia. So as soon as Dennis O saw our chat in Discord, the message was immediately sent. Oh no, did I miss a talk about Sophia? It's like, yeah, sorry. If you normally he's in the show, but wasn't in that this last week. So he had some updates for us. If you remember, I was talking about the secondary mirror being configurable and I was like, I don't know what this means. Here's what it is. So partially configurable refers to the fact that it, can change its focus, to adjust for, temperature changes throughout the flight. So it can adapt to those. But it also has a thing called chopping, which is where it can move from side to side. And Dennis O gave a lovely analogy that really makes this easy to understand. So if you're using a telescope, one of the things you can do is to look at your target and then look away from your target. And that will let you subtract one image from the other and get control for the background noise a little bit. We do that on this show with our audio. David will take sections of the audio where we're not talking, and in Audacity, he'll capture the sound of the room and then have Audacity take out that sound from everything else. So that makes sense for like a primary mirror where like you point your telescope and then you move it away. Well, in this case, you also have a lot of noise from the vehicle itself. And so the secondary mirror can move in and out of place so you can get an image without the background noise from the vehicle, from like the telescope itself. So that's really cool. I wish I would have known that to mention that, because that's really fantastic. And then I also mentioned that they used cameras for tracking and stabilization. And so here's some more information about that. There are actually three cameras. There's WFI and FFI, the wide and fine field imagers. And those are used to help with tracking. And I was kind of like, yeah, maybe it's like a spotter scope. I think that's a pretty fair guess. And then Dennis O says that the tertiary mirror is actually a dichroic. It's a beam splitter, so that it reflects infrared light to the science instrument, but then the visible light can mostly or maybe entirely pass through the tertiary mirror, to a focal plane imager. So that's really clever, right? Because you want to be imaging in infrared, but the visible light is still going to be good for something. And so you pass that out so that you can focus using the visible light and not interrupt, the infrared light chain. It's very cool. And then, Vax Headroom, also chimed in. He shot some footage in 2012, aboard and just outside of Sophia. Really old footage. It looks like it was shot on a camera that had been, the lens looked smeared. And when I first pulled it up, I was like, come on, man, wipe your camera off. And then I realized how long ago this was shot. And I was like, oh no, this is fantastic footage. So, go check that out. There's, some discussions with, some of the scientists on board, and it's a nice little tour.
Welcome to the interview portion of the show. We are here with Jeff Williams, the CEO / CTO of Exum Instruments. Jeff, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for having me. I'm really excited.
Yeah, me too. We got a lot of cool things to talk about, but I guess to start things off, maybe you could just give us a little kind of overview of, who you are and how you found yourself founding Exum Instruments.
Yeah, so my background was in geology to start with. So I was a climber who decided he liked rocks a lot and wanted to then start studying rocks. Never really thought of myself as being very good at science or math, but turns out if I had a reason to like it, I was pretty good. So I kind of went down that path of geology, which then had some just great mentors and professors at Florida State that then brought me into the National High Magnetic Field Lab there, into the geochemistry side. I turned out really had liked chemistry and geology. And so it was like, oh, perfect. Geochemistry sounds great. And I'd always been kind of a space nerd as well, just, you know, growing up in Florida with the shuttle launches and, I don't know, just was always very attracted to that space and, you know, big sci-fi kid for sure. And then it turns out when I could study meteorites and this whole world opened up of cosmochemistry, went down that path and got really excited by, you know, all of this knowledge and information of the solar system that, you know, you don't really think that we have. So I really got to dive into that and decided that I wanted to continue down that path. Did my graduate work at the University of New Mexico on stable isotope work, again, in cosmochemistry, really looking at solar system formation, Mars formation, that sort of thing. But I guess, you know, how do you go from cosmochemistry to building mass spectrometers in a garage? You know, I've always been a maker, always taking things apart. My mom used to hide things from me so that I wouldn't take them apart. And then I was lucky enough that both of my advisors, both at National High Magnetic Field Lab and at University of New Mexico, were people without patience for field technicians to come fix their instruments. And so we would just take them apart and fix them ourselves. And from that, I really got to learn, you know, how the mass specs work. So I learned a lot of like just kind of first principles physics of, you know, what's going on there. First principles electronics, ion optics, that sort of thing. Simultaneously to that, I was working a lot with data from the Curiosity rover, from the ChemCam, which is the big masthead that you see on the robot there. It's actually what's called a LIB system. And the data was really frustrating. And it's kind of a controversial topic, but I always joke like the weight percent of magnesium on Mars could vary by like 10% day to day, depending upon who was processing the data. It was just a very frustrating instrument to standardize, to really get meaningful quantitation out of. It's a really amazing tool for kind of quick analysis, understanding what elements are there, but getting to like a real quantitative answer that cosmochemists and geochemists need to, you know, make this big stories off of four data points that we're so good at, takes high precision. So anyway, from that came up with this idea, and decided I was kind of, you know, disillusioned with academia at the time. And I wanted to build a laser-based system that had the power of mass spectrometry. And we could talk a little bit later about kind of the state of where a lot of like solid sample mass spec is right now and why I wanted to make this into a system that, you know, could ultimately be designed for a rover. But, you know, I decided that this could have a lot of impact here on Earth as well. So I dropped out of my PhD program and mastered out and started going to government options and building a mass spec in a garage.
That's awesome. I've gotten that sense as an outsider that when it comes to geology and kind of earth science people, they often find it's hard and complicated enough to study the earth. And then when they watch the other people go extraterrestrial and try to, you know, study Mars and elsewhere, that it can be that just adds another layer of challenge to it, I suppose. And I guess is behind the idea behind MassBox to try to, try to beat that down a little bit.
Yeah, it's exactly right. You know, in geochemistry, we do have the advantage where we can get 1,000 data points from basalts from the world, right, for some study. And with Martian meteorites, maybe you have 5 data points, and then you're building an entire story of the solar system from 5 data points, right? So it's really important that those data points are very good.
Well, so Dennis, you already mentioned MassBox. That's Is that your one product right now, or is it one of a few products?
Yeah, so it's our sole product right now. You know, ultimately, XM is not the mass box. XM, you know, the mass box is just the first product. But right now, that's really where we're focused. And it's really to fill this gap, both terrestrially and extraterrestrially, of solid sample chemical analysis. So right now, we're really focused on inorganic. So measuring the elements, how much chlorine, how much iron, how much uranium. But we do have plans to move this also into doing organic analysis at the same time.
Cool. So what is mass spec?
Yeah, so mass spectrometry is a huge field, but essentially it's, you know, a mass spectrum. So we're separating things out by how much do they weigh. So it's a lot easier to start with an understanding of this in the elements, right? So every element has a set number of stable isotopes, right? So in the case of titanium, there's 5 isotopes, and they have a given natural ratio here on Earth and on our solar system. And so if we were to put those into a system that could separate those out by mass, we would always see the same pattern. And I like titanium because it kind of looks like somebody flipping you off in the isotope pattern. It's like really easy to recognize. But that's what you would see no matter if you ran a mass spectrometer that had a, you know, one ionization source versus another one. You're always going to see the exact same thing versus something that's looking at light, whether that be X-rays or whether that be visible light. There's going to be different principles that you're looking at. What electron are you looking at and what orbital and all these sorts of things, so that titanium could look very different instrument to instrument. So I always like to think about mass spectrometry as like kind of the ground truth of measurement of whether it's molecules or elements. And there's really 3 major components there. We need an ion. So we need to take something and we need to rip off an electron. We need to give it an electron. We need to give it a hydrogen discharge so that we can talk to it with an electric field. We need to then usually have some sort of like collimation system. So you could think about this in the same way we do with lasers and light. We can form electric fields in order to make an ion beam, which goes right into the mass analyzer. So some system to separate out how these masses, right? So whether that's using principles like a magnetic field to separate how they move through a magnetic field and separate out in space, or what we use, which is called time of flight. So if we kick all the masses with the same energy, they'll separate out by velocity, just like kicking a soccer ball or a bowling ball. And then we need to detect them, right? So we need to have some sort of way of detecting them in time or in space.
So real quick, you mentioned that you like titanium because it's easy to recognize. And I don't think most people are going to be familiar with what the output of a mass spec looks like. And could you talk about, like, when you get your report back, what are you actually looking at?
Yeah, so we'll start with like the simplest form, I think, to understand is let's go with like a time of flight mass spectrometer. So we'll probably be talking about that mostly. So like I said, we have these ions. We kick them really hard with, you know, a big pulse voltage. And now they're going to fly out and separate it as a function. And if you imagine putting a detector kind of at the end of a field, and you kick the soccer ball and a bowling ball, and, you know, the soccer ball's going to get there much faster. And so the same thing's true as if we were to look in time, all of a sudden you'd see a peak come up, and there's your hydrogen. You wait a little bit longer. You see 2 peaks come up. That's your lithium-6, lithium-7. Then you wait a little bit longer. You see your boron, so on and so forth. So what we see is these peaks that are varying ratios as a function of the relative abundance of those isotopes. So like I said, lithium has 2 isotopes, 6 and 7, and the ratio is constant. So we're always going to get this fingerprint for an element, and we're going to see it in time. And we're going to then have these peaks from mass. Well, we'll convert time to mass. So we'll see from, you know, mass 0 or 1 to 238 for uranium. And we'll see all of the elements out there. And they all kind of have these distinct patterns. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that's a great explanation. So it's, I mean, is it technically a histogram?
So
I can't decide because it's not really right bucketing things. It's more like just a chart, I guess.
It's a chart. Yeah. Think of it more like an old school needle printer, you know, like for like a seismograph or something.
Mm. You know? Oh, yeah.
And like all the elements are hitting and making the seismograph move, right?
I like that. Yeah.
And now that's for TOF. Now there's other sorts of mass spectrometry that actually use like a frequency space. So these are things like ion traps or what's called ion cyclotron resonance, which basically you can like get these things to spin in a certain magnetic or electric field. And then the masses will, you can basically listen to the frequency of the mass and turn that into the mass itself very, very precisely, actually. Mm-hmm. But that's a little bit more complicated.
I'm wondering, I feel like I can understand the physics of after you've got your ions, you know, traveling into your, like through your machine and, you know, encountering magnetic and electric fields. How do you control just how ionized your, you know, I guess your input ions are, right? Because I mean, different, you know, elements are going to be holding on to their mm-hmm. electrons differently. And how, and would it matter if you knocked off two or, you know, you was doubly or triply ionized instead of just being singly, or how do you control for that in a machine?
Like, yeah, no, that's a really good question. And this is kind of the whole thing, right? So we have really the novelty of mass spec. Like, yeah, there's clever things being done on the back end, but really a lot of the novelty now is on the front end. It is how do we make sure that we are ionizing things the way we want to ionize them? We're saturating the ionization, and then we're keeping the highest efficiency possible from the ionization to the detector, right? And we end up with a lot of what are called matrix effects as well. And I think this is, you know, what you were getting at is if you had a lot of different elements in there, let's say chlorine and sodium, right? And on the first ionization potentials, they're very different. Sodium loves to ionize, chlorine not so much, right? And therefore, if you're analyzing something, you could end up with a very different response factor to how does chlorine travel through your system versus sodium. And so this is really the key point. And so what we're left with on the market is you have a lot of different sources. It's kind of like the best ionization source is a plasma, right? We know plasmas are just so good at ripping off electrons. But the challenge with a plasma, in order to get a really nice plasma, is obviously you're usually using like an argon gas, for example. And so therefore it's at a high pressure, but your detector and your ion optics want to be at vacuum, right? So ICP-MS is a really amazing technology that has, you know, a near perfect ionization efficiency up to whatever the gas that is obviously creating the plasma. So normally argon, but the challenge is you're going from atmosphere to vacuum. And then you start to get effects of how do the heavier elements move inside of the plasma before they're entering these cones to get into a vacuum system that's going down to like 10 to the minus 7 millibars. So there's all sorts of these nuances to what happened there. The other challenge, the way to think about this space too, is the best way to analyze a solid currently before the mass stocks is still to digest it in a bunch of acid. Right. So putting it into a liquid form is much easier to deal with than trying to get a reliable answer out of a solid. And this is really why the mass spec is, you know, after being cheap grad student labor, you know, you understand why, because nobody else wants to do the work for this stuff. And I wanted to create a technique that would get you the data faster from your solid so that you could actually, you know, do meaningful science or do meaningful work in industry and not have to have two PhD chemists or an army of grad students to run it.
I see. Okay, cool. That does make sense. And Magnus, a lot of nuances to say the least. Right. You can write it down as like a simple, you know, physics problem, like a 200 level physics problem that you could solve in, you know, 5 minutes. But if you actually want to design one of these, taking all that into account. Interesting.
So the difficulty, you talked about dissolving your sample in a liquid because it's easier to handle. Doing this on a solid, that's one of the reasons that ChemCam had varying results, right? Am I remembering that correctly? That you're saying that ChemCam was giving different results depending on who's processing the data. And I'm assuming that is coming back from the fact that you can't dissolve things in acid on Mars. You just hit it with a laser and go with what you got.
Yeah. ChemCam was using a system called LIBS, which is a really cool technology. And basically, you take a laser. It's amazing what NASA was able to do, how far away they could focus. But they would take the laser, they'd focus it down to a small point on a rock, and it would ablate material and create an instantaneous plasma, right? And they then would look at the light in that plasma and be able to tell, like, okay, this is this band for magnesium, this is this band for iron, this is this band for lanthanum, right? And so you end up with this really complex spectrum of light that's coming from that plasma from the ablation. It's only lasting, you know, a microsecond, right? So it's very fast, very instantaneous. I'm sure if you've ever dealt with any kind of laser ablation, you've always seen that kind of blue light that happens when it's interacting with the material. That's a plasma that dissipates very quickly. But The challenge is a plasma, you know, you're only putting so much energy into the system, and it's then the crystal lattice is, you know, breaking apart, releasing a bunch of energy, but it's still an energy limited environment. And so depending upon what elements are now in this plume that are being broken apart, they're going to ionize in a very nonlinear way. It's very like multidimensional. And so you have this multivariate space where understanding if the integral of sodium at 100 and the integral of sodium at 88 actually means that there was a 10% or 12% change in the sodium, or if that's a 3% change because you had a little bit more magnesium and that changed the way the sodium behaves, right? And it's now possible with obviously these large statistical models we can build, but we didn't do a good job of that with ChemKit before setting it up just because, you know, timelines. LIBS is getting better, but it's still very difficult to get a reliable answer unless you're analyzing the same thing day in, day out, right? Like if you're only analyzing wood, right? And you know that you're only going to be looking for the carbon content of wood, you can make a much more robust model because you have a very limited matrix looking at. But if you went to go from wood to metal to plastics, you're in just totally different spaces.
Just a basic question. So when you're measuring, you know, these masses and you're determining various isotopes, like, is it not possible that maybe two atoms that are different elements have the same mass just because of, you know, the number of neutrons on that atom? And how do you differentiate between those two?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So yeah, this is what's called an isobaric interference. So like there's lots of classic examples of this, but like rubidium and strontium have one, for example, on mass 87. So there's an isotope of rubidium and there's an isotope of strontium on mass 87. And if you were to look at it with most instruments, you can't resolve those two peaks, even though there is a slight change in mass. So I don't know the exact numbers. Let's just pretend rubidium is mass 86.97 and strontium is 87.1, right? So it's very small amounts of mass difference that we're dealing with. So on most instruments, you would see just one peak. And so it depends on the work that we're doing. So if I'm speaking from the perspective of, I want to know how much rubidium and how much strontium is in the system, like just quantitatively PPM, is there 10 PPM or 20 PPM? I would then look at a different isotope. So I would just say, okay, well, I'm ignoring that 87 peak. It's a mess. We're going to look at 85. We're going to look at 88. And we're only going to use those peaks to determine the amount of rubidium or strontium, because we don't need to measure every isotope, because, you know, we're going to make an assumption within, like, you know, on the per mil level that the isotope ratios are the same for most of the samples you're going to handle, unless you're doing something like nuclear related, right? So we can look at a different isotope. But if I were to, and this is like a whole other field of this type of science, is let's say I wanted to use the rubidium strontium because it's a really good dating technique, right? Because if I can look at the, you know, rubidium 85, 87, and the strontium 88, 87 ratios, and I want to know those isotopic ratios super precisely, either you need to have a very, very high mass resolving power where you can separate out those two peaks. So this goes into kind of more complex mass spectrometers that have a very high resolution, or you need to do a bunch of digestion and column chemistry that allows you to selectively, you know, remove the rubidium so you can measure the strontium or vice versa. But yeah, this is generally solved by, let's look at a different isotope. The only trouble you run into is if you have a monoisotopic element that happens to have one. I don't have an example off the top of my head where that is the case, but monoisotopic elements, you run into other issues. But this is how we use this pattern to verify that it actually is the element. and all of the ratios are kind of the, what we expect them to be.
Okay, so we've talked about some of the ways that it's difficult to do this front end work where we're plasmatizing our sample so that we can do science on it. You've settled on a technology called LALI, laser ablation, laser ionization. And I think it's really fun after having this exact conversation where we've talked about using lasers to ablate that you would then have a repeated, this phrase is like repeated, we're going to do laser ablation and laser ionization. And they're not the same lasers. I mean, they are, but they're two different assemblies. How does this work and why is it helpful?
Yeah, so this actually comes from what I was describing earlier from this idea around, you know, having instruments that were really good at ionizing, but then obviously had this pressure differential they had to operate between. And one of those systems was coupling a laser ablation system into the gas flow that then goes into this ICP-MS, the plasma, that then goes into the mass spectrometer. And it's an amazing technology, but it's not elegant, right? It's never going to, you're never going to put in the system, you know, on a rover. Hell, you're barely going to ever see these in industry. You're only going to really see these in academic or research institutions. And, but the laser ablation sampling itself is just so powerful, right? Because you just take a solid in there and sample it. And so there had been some work, like all great things done in the 80s, that there was work around laser ablation going directly into a mass spectrometer that was using that plasma we talked about as the ion source into a mass spec, had some advantages, very low sensitivity, still difficult to quantitate. And then there was other work that used another technology of like using a laser to ionize a plume from a different sort of technology, which used an ion beam to drill. And they found a lot of success in the ionization technique. And people had kind of mentioned in papers, kind of just in passing, like, you know, you could probably do this with laser ablation, but there really hadn't been a lot of work of putting these two things together. And also at the time when this work was done, we just didn't have, you know, fast enough processing for this. Laser technologies were really large, really expensive. It was never going to be a practical instrument. And so when I was getting to look at this again, I kind of realized like we kind of had all the pieces and somebody just needed to put this together. And so laser ablation, laser ionization was born out of these two concepts of one, let's do the ablation inside a vacuum with a mass spectrometer. And two, let's do the ionization of the neutral plume. And why that's important is everything I just talked about with LIBS, you know, I don't want that plasma. That plasma has just so many matrix effects. It's so complicated. And it also requires a different optimization of what type of laser you're using and how much heat and energy are you putting into the sample. Because in a plasma, you want to like basically, you know, create as much of a plasma as possible. So put more energy, longer time spans. So nanosecond lasers are better than like, let's say, ultra fast lasers. And what I wanted to do was say, well, let's not look at the plasma. How would we optimize for using the laser for making a perfect neutral particle plume? So that like in an ideal world, if I take that laser spot and I removed a small cylindrical volume, that's the laser spot size by the depth that it removed, and every single atom that came off of that surface was a neutral atom. And then I want to look at now. So now it's basically perfectly stoichiometric, right? So for every three atoms of sodium, there's one atom of iron, which is the exact same thing as it was in the solid, right? So now this gas phase is the exact same as this. Now, how would I get this into a mass spectrometer? We need to ionize it. Okay, let's throw another laser on there because you know, lasers. So I decided like, let's look at this other work. So we use, another laser that's in the UV, and we can go back and talk about how I optimized the primer here in a second, but we use another laser that's 266 nanometers, and which is equivalent to 4.66 EV, right? So every photon has 4.66 EV of energy. And if you look at majority of the periodic table, let's say like 85% of the periodic table's first ionization potential is less than 9.33 EV, or two photons worth of energy from this 266 laser. So what we can do is we can keep increasing the power more and more and more until we saturate this two photon regime, right? So we're trying to ionize as many elements in the that plume as possible. And when we saturate it, what that means is that every atom that laser is touching is going to be ionized. And it's going to be ionized whether or not it was a 8 EV FIP or a 6 EV FIP, right? Because they're all being saturated. And I think one of you guys asked about like, well, what about like doubly charged and triply charged? And you're absolutely right. You will start to see doubly charged ions, you know, showing up because some elements, you know, like there's going to be an electron there that's going to want to come off to become a 2+ ion faster than another one. And so in the mass spectrum, you're kind of always playing this balance game of how do I saturate the two photon, but not also make too many, two photon, but not also make too many doubly charged ion species. I want just singly charged. And also I want enough power there so that I can still ionize the really hard elements, the three photon elements, but I'm not going to saturate them. And so what this ultimately allows for, just from like a first principles perspective, is if I have a really stoichiometric plume, I'm saturating the ionization and I'm already in vacuum. Well, now I can create a pretty simple ion optic system, relatively simple, and bolt it onto a time of flight mass spectrometer, which allows me to get every element at every laser shot. And I have a very quantitative method. And because it's a mass spectrometer, it's very sensitive, right? Like mass specs can go down to like parts per trillion level of detection. We don't go down that low, but they're much more sensitive than, let's say, like a photo detector of any kind. So that allows us to, get low limits of detection and very quantitative. And the other really cool thing is now we have a pixel, right? And at every pixel, we have a dimension that is the mass spectrum. And so if we were to scan our sample, kind of like an old CRT TV, right? Now we can create a chemical image. Now, not only can we do the quantitative work at every pixel, but we can put it in context. You know, we can tell you where is your lithium, where is your iron, all of these sorts of things. And you're creating a whole new dimension of like, how do you look at it? It's not just, it has 40 PPM iron. It's, well, yes, on average it does, but you have these massive hotspots of 100% iron, right? So it's a different way of looking at your chemistry.
I was wondering when you're playing this game of trying to saturate the incoming material, mm-hmm. while not messing around with the ionization levels too much. Can you tune what that laser would be firing? Actually, what kind of energies it would be? Ionizing based on if you have a rough idea, like okay, well I'm sending in a piece of metal versus a rock versus something like totally different. Like, can you try to guess ahead almost? And
yeah, this is actually a really cool thing. So I think there's two ways to answer this. Like, one, if you're just doing the whole periodic table and you care and you want to see everything all the time, you want to do what we call, which is called non-resonant ionization. So it's just hitting it with a hammer, right? But what you're getting at though is, what if I were to tune it for a specific electron in a specific orbital in a specific element? So I only want to ionize my rubidium. So if we go back to the question, I can't remember if maybe Ben asked about like the isobaric interferences, what if I could just ionize the rubidium and not the strontium? So this is a whole really cool field called resonance ionization, which is not something that we're doing commercially right now. But you could actually put in a tunable laser and get the wavelength down to like, you know, the hundredth of a lambda, right? And put two colors in there or three colors in there. And the only thing that's going to ionize is that specific electron in that specific orbital. So your mass spectrum is just rubidium. And that's a really cool technique.
And the purpose of that would just be to detect how much of it you have, because obviously if you're fine tuning it, then you already are assuming it's there, right? Like,
yes. Yeah. So they do this a lot for, or they have done this a lot in the past, especially for precious samples that they, the reason why this technique was developed was actually instruments like, it's called Charisma. And this was done because we really want to know really high precision of certain isotope systems in the solar system. So let's say we wanted to measure the molybdenum isotope from, let's say, the Genesis mission or the OSIRIS-REx mission or Stardust, things like this, where we have, you know, a precious amount of sample material. And we know that we really need to get this pinned down on molybdenum because this is going to really tell us a lot about certain, you know, solar system events, let's say, or how many stars were mixed into, you know, our kind of primordial pool of elements before our solar system. So we want to nail down molybdenum, but we don't want to digest a gram of this material just to get a molybdenum element, right? It's kind of a waste of material. NASA is not going to like that. But what if we could use a technique like this one? In this case, it used SIMS, which is kind of the technology I was describing. So this uses an ion beam. And then we use this resonant ionization. So, I mean, we're removing like femtograms of material, but we're able to very precisely and very sensitively measure just the molybdenum. And that way, you know, from a dollar per gram for analysis, it's a pretty good bang for your buck.
Then I guess we need to move on and talk about the time of flight or TOF aspect. This is like the back end. How are you actually using, what are you bouncing off of and what are you measuring the time of?
So the TOF itself, so we made our ions. We do some ion optics, which, you know, for people who aren't familiar, like you can shape electric fields very similarly to how you can shape optical assemblies, right? So imagine glass and how it's kind of like refracting and bending the light. And it's all a function of the geometry of the optic, right? You can do the exact same thing with an electric field. You can use a certain shape to generate the propagation of an electric field that mimics like a lens, right? And so we can take these ions and we can make them now into a collimated beam. We can do all sorts of crazy stuff, putting them in RF fields that do different things. But let's just take the idea of that it's a collimated beam. And now it's collimated and it's traveling really, really fast. And it's going to come across literally a plate, right? And when it's across that plate, we're going to pulse the entire packet of ions. And when I mean by pulse it, we're going to go like near probably like less than a nanosecond rise time up to like 1,000 volts, usually a lot higher, but let's just say 1,000 volts of a DC square wave. So very fast, very strong. And what that's going to do is it's going to kick all of those ions 90 degrees to the motion that they had. And now they have two vectors. They have their original vector that they were traveling in parallel to the plate. And now they have the larger vector, which is, you know, normal to the plate, right? And so they're kind of traveling at an angle. And when they're traveling, the hydrogen's going to take more of that energy and convert it into speed, right? Velocity. So hydrogen's going to go very, 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 very fast. Right. And uranium is going to go very slow. And actually what we do is we use a system called a reflectron, which is basically a stack of metal plates with a hole in them is the easiest way to think about it. And we create an increasing voltage gradient. So whether linear or quadratic, but it's just getting stronger and stronger. And the way to visualize this is like a half pipe. Right. So, or you can do this by yourself, but it's like folding up a piece of paper to make like a ramp. And if you were to roll a ball at an angle up that ramp, it would come out the other end at the same angle, right? So it would create like a U profile. And so we have all these elements traveling. They go up the ramp. They come back down the ramp, and they're still traveling with some, you know, with some angle to them. And then we have a detector positioned at a certain place in space where those ions are going to hit. And by the time they hit that detector, they separate it out to a sufficient amount that we've calculated that is enough resolving power. The longer the length of the time of flight, the more separation you have, but also the more challenging it can be to focus and control or to not lose ions along the way, right? So you're kind of, those are the knobs that you're turning. So then the ions hit this detector, and these are very fast detectors. So a lot of times they're detectors called MCPs. There's a few other styles, but MCPs are probably the most common. These are called multi-channel plate detectors. They're basically a bunch of glass tubes that are stuck together as close as possible. They're coated with like a carbon coating on the inside of the tubes, and they basically allow for like an analog amplification. These are used a lot for telescopes as well, so for light. Basically, anything that's going to hit this coating is going to allow for... The easiest way is one ion hits it, two electrons come off, then four electrons come off, then 16 electrons come off, right? And then at the bottom of it is a collector, right? So then you get a pulse of current or voltage. that comes out of it. And they have to be able to recover very quickly because we're talking on the order of like nanoseconds, right? Where you'll get the hydrogen peak and then we need to be ready back to background before lithium comes and then back to background before boron comes, right? So they have to be very fast detectors, but they also have to allow for a high amount of dynamic range. So anyway, the signal comes out of the detector into, you know, an ADC or data acquisition system. And then we read that. And then we need to correct that data because it's not actually linear, right? So hydrogen doesn't fly 238 times faster than uranium. It's actually like a lot faster than that. And then it tends to shallow out. So uranium will be just a little bit faster than, let's say, tungsten, right? So it's very, very big difference in the light masses and very small differences in the heavy masses. So then we need to linearize time to mass, essentially, because straight out of the detector, it won't be linear. We apply like a polynomial correction to it. Now we have a linear mass scale. And now we can look at the peak for lithium, find both sides of the peak, and then we can just do a simple integration on it. And that tells us, with a calibration, how many atoms of lithium hit the detector.
Does this linearization, this calibration, is that specific to the ion optics that you set up? Or is that a more general thing that, like, since people have been creating these, we know? Or does every, like, system that's built, not like each physical device, but does each one just need to be calibrated? Like, we created a mass spectrometer of a certain style, and now we got to basically run everything from, like, uranium through hydrogen through it? Or like,
yeah, no, essentially, that I wish everything behaved as well in the models as it does in real life, you know, but yeah, we end up with kind of like every experimental physics or any type of instrument. You always need a ground truthing of like, hey, it should behave like this, but let's actually just run a bunch of knowns through it and then create a empirical calibration.
Okay. So we are a space show and we've just spent a lot of time talking about things on the ground. Whether or not they have lasers, we still would like to get to space. And so you've got a fun development for MassBox that does actually get us to space. Can you tell us about that?
We are putting a MassBox on the space station, which is a really, really exciting project. So this is going to be the first like true, you know, mass spectrometer. There's been some gas phase stuff that's done in the past, but this is going to be the first one to really analyze samples on the ISS. So we're taking our design and we're making it space flight ready. And, you know, because of our system as well, it's much more compact and able to actually sit in one of these rack systems. And the goal here is, right now it's just a proof of concept of let's get on the space station, let's do some analysis, prove that it's, you know, very easy to use, ground controlled, and that it can provide a value. Because right now, when you think about all the new commercial focus on the ISS or on the new Axiom platform as well, you know, it's not just about being a national lab up there anymore. It's how do we actually create a space economy, right? So grow crystals on space station, grow proteins, pharmaceuticals, new materials. And we need a way of like gut checking that we're doing the right thing. And right now, the best way to do that is to send it down. And down mass is very expensive, right? So if we can instead put a system up there that allows somebody to grow a crystal, put it in the mass box, check for purity, or grow some new protein and pharmaceutical, put it in the mass box and check for, did it do what you think that it was supposed to do? Look for contamination, all of these sorts of things that, you know, we're really good at, and giving the capabilities on space, it can really start to accelerate the development and the process control for new space materials and ultimately for the space economy. And the larger vision from that is, yeah, then we want to be on the lunar bases, on the Martian bases, you know, really focusing on the material development, the material processing, all of this sort of thing.
And even though we're talking about, you know, a high-tech instrument, I read it somewhere, MassBox draws like 200, 300 watts. Like it's very reasonable.
Yeah, very low power. And that has to do a lot with like the duty cycle of our lasers. They're high power lasers, but they're only running, you know, at max, our ionization laser is running for 9 nanoseconds, right? So it's still a very low continuous wattage that's used when it's only at 20 hertz, let's say. And then it's just two turbo molecular pumps. And, you know, on the ISS, it's even lower because we don't need to send a computer up there. We don't need to send a backing pump, which I was really, at first I was excited. I was like, man, we can just like, where's your guys' hole to space? We don't even need a vacuum system.
Right.
Apparently the ISS frowns upon holes to space.
Do you think you'd actually want it? It's a fairly dirty vacuum. Like, how clean of a vacuum do you need?
Yeah, that's also the other thing, right? They're not in like, they're still low Earth orbit, right? So it's not like the perfect vacuum. Yeah, it would have been nice, but it would have been a great backing pump.
Oh, okay.
Right? So, but then you're losing a lot of mass, losing a lot of air when you're doing it that way.
True.
It's still a very closed system.
Yeah. A controlled leak for science.
Exactly. The astronauts don't need it. They'll be fine.
So what does making MassBox flight ready look like? What have you done so far? What's on your checklist? And especially, are there any things that have surprised you so far?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the first order one, right, is being on a rocket is very different than being very carefully transported and put on a desk and never touched. So that's kind of like the first order challenge is, hey, how do we get like vibration ready? You know, we have a bunch of optic systems in here. And, you know, you can compensate for a lot of this by saying, oh, well, we'll just like realign when it's up there. But also NASA really frowns on astronauts exposing themselves to lasers in space. So then you have to look at it from, okay, now we need like an auto alignment system or really robust optical design, which is not impossible. I mean, we put, you know, complex laser systems on the tip of helicopters' blades. Like, we can do some clever things as humans for sure. So, you know, it's a lot about reassessing our optical design systems. How do we actually, what you're really optimizing for, which I learned, is astronaut time is very expensive and NASA doesn't like giving it up, right? And so it's how can we do as much as possible with the littlest amount of astronaut input? So the only thing we really want the astronauts doing is like loading and unloading a sample. And for the very first test, we're actually going to fly with the samples already in the system, right? We're going to have some standards up there, get it all working, and the astronauts won't even know that it's running other than the fact that when they install it, right? And then once we get to a certain point, it's like, okay, system's calibrated, it's running, we're happy with it. Now let's go look at some of our other partners and who's growing some new materials that they wanted to be analyzed. And then we're going to, you know, work out the contracts there. But yeah, I think the first surprise was astronaut time is very expensive. Don't use it if you don't have to. Do as much on the Earth from a control perspective as possible. So actually having like a downlink to be able to, you know, control the instrument. And then the other parts of it that are challenging for us still is like, we do have cooling systems and space is really bad at cooling things. Mm-hmm. And so you have to be really careful with the heat flux. And it's something that they monitor super importantly. We've never even thought about it because we're like, ah, what do we care? Right? We just put more water. It's fine.
Convection. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. So now it's like actually quantifying, understanding what our heat flux is so that we can tell NASA like, hey, we're not going to like warm up this, you know, the whole ISS, or we're also not going to overload your own cooling system, because they have kind of like all of these systems built in. And we can theoretically just plug right into them, right? Like go into the ISS cooling line and put it through our lasers, but it's never that easy. So that's been another challenge for sure. On the electrical side, it's actually easier than expected because they have so many different options that are readily available. And already having everything in DC on the ISS really helps as well. So our electronics actually become a lot simpler, which is nice. And then it's also funny, I think the other thing is that, you know, if you're not useful, you don't get space. So like you can go up there with this, with what we have now to go on the ISS and say everything goes great, but something goes wrong and like the instrument goes down and it needs a part or whatever. You're getting pulled out of that rack and you're getting put on the roof rack of the ISS. Like they don't want you in the space, the system, right? And like, that's it. Like they, you know, if they can put you in storage, they will, because space is just such a commodity up there, which obviously makes sense. So, you know, we expect that, you know, our primary mission objective is to get up there, get analysis done, prove that this is a technology that can be very beneficial for the future projects, both for the Axiom transition and commercial space readiness, but then, you know, also going to the lunar missions as well and showing that, hey, if you're going to try to be doing some 3D printing on the moon, you probably want to know what it's made of pretty good. Or if you're going to be making materials and all sorts of things. So we're really, really trying to put a flag down of like, this is a technology that's going to help enable the space economy.
So you had mentioned earlier about heat flux that this generates. I was just curious, how much heat are we talking about? And was that something that was like a huge deal? Or is that just like NASA being very, very cautious because, you know, that's what they're going to do?
Yeah, it is a big deal for a NASA perspective. For us, we think that it won't be an issue, but actually like getting the answer on that is something that we're still doing. Especially because of just the style of laser that we use has a lot of like waste heat versus the amount of light out. It's not a super efficient system. So that's something that we're kind of looking at. I don't think that we'll be like above a threshold, but it is something that NASA looks at, you know, very specifically because they have to have a full heat budget, right? And so if they're going to run the mass box, they need to make sure that they're also not running their furnace at the same time or something, right?
And then we were also recommended to ask you about how mass spec can be helpful to aerospace manufacturing. I'm assuming we've already talked about like 90% of that answer, but I wanted to throw that at you as well.
Yeah, sure. So there's a lot of different facets here. The primary thing is, you know, we're getting more and more clever with metallurgy, right? So whether it's high entropy alloys or novel aluminum, you know, and everything in between. And as a function of that, the tolerance for what gives the material its property becomes tighter and tighter. And that really comes down to how much tungsten's in there, how much nickel's in there, how much copper. And where maybe there was like a pretty large error in the past that was allowed, let's say in kind of general steel industry, it's like, it's plus or minus a few percent. Like, and that's fine because the mechanical properties didn't change by a ton for, let's say, 80% of applications. Then you had more and more tightly controlled grades. But as we go into these kind of like next generation materials, it really becomes next generation precision requirements as well on chemistry. I mean, we were just on a call where like they want to know the aluminum and their metals, you know, it's supposed to be 500 ppm and it can't be more than 520 ppm. Right? Because like that 20 ppm difference starts to completely change the characteristics for what they're controlling for. So we're starting to get into this level of precision requirements, and especially on 3D printing side, right? So one of it's just on the alloy manufacturing, making, and then there's also like a whole reverse engineering side, which is a funny thing that we're kind of really big into now, which is we've lost the drawings and material specifications for like most of our fleet. You know, our B-52s were built in like the 1950s and like a steering yoke breaks and we don't know what it was made of, right? And if we're going to like 3D print something, how do we make sure that it's the right material? Well, we can use the mass box to reverse engineer it, say it's this alloy with this much aluminum, whatever it might be. And then we can go spec out the 3D printed powder to say, hey, it has to match this. Then we could 3D print it, make sure that it actually alloyed properly, right? Because in subtractive manufacturing, you kind of have this more or less homogeneous block that you're making your part out of. In additive manufacturing, you're alloying as you're making the part along it, right? And you need to make sure that, you know, that's held constant, especially if you're starting to get kind of clever with mixing powders together. So we're able to look at that not only from like a purity perspective, but also in space, going back to that chemical imaging. You know, do you have a lot of hot spots of impurity? Do you have spots of high oxygen? That's something that's really important, right? Is the amount of oxygen that's in the system. Is there voids as well? And then, okay, you made a part out of it and maybe you used 20% of the powder in the chamber. Can I reuse that powder? Well, that's where we can use the mass box to analyze that powder, try and say, yep, it passed the test for reuse. Because right now it's either you have like, the majors will basically say, I need virgin powder for every part because we just don't know enough. Or you have some study that only had enough money to run it 7 times. And therefore they said, you can run it 7 times. And it's like, why? Well, we ran it 7 times, right? So there's, you know, now we can actually start to get like, where is that limit of how long you can run it for?
And then Dennis O in the chat also had another very good question that I totally flaked on. So when is MassBox actually scheduled to go to ISS? Do you have a tentative launch date yet?
Yeah, we got a ride on a Falcon 9 for like Q1 of 26.
Wow.
So a little longer out than we initially expected. But in space terms, I guess it's still pretty fast.
Yeah, no, that's really fast.
Yeah, so super excited for that. So yeah, we'll definitely be posting a bunch on our LinkedIn and other socials as well of when we're going to be doing there, and we're taking the whole company to the launch for sure. But anyway, so we're trying to also figure out how do we make this future proof to go over to the Axiom system as well. And the answer might be we're going to send up another one that's like more dedicated, but we're going to try for both as well.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Jeff. That was a lot of fun. So we've got our final two questions, and our penultimate one is, where would you like to be found on the internet?
Yeah. So find us, xminstruments.com is going to be our main company's website. And you can find me on LinkedIn, Jeff Williams. You'll find me as CEO, CTO of X. And I'm sorry, I'm not on Instagram or Twitter, so that's all you get.
for such a common name, I was shocked that I was able to find you on LinkedIn right away. It was really easy.
that's good. Because normally, even if I go to like a climbing gym, they're like, which Jeff Williams are you? I have 24.
Right. And our final question is actually a question about a question. And I just rewrote, because this... I'm still fine tuning the wording of this. So I just rewrote it. So we'll see how much of an improvement I made, but what is a question that you find very interesting, but doesn't hold much importance in your field? And I'm looking specifically for a question, that you haven't been able to find an answer to yet. So like an open question,
I guess, philosophically, the question I'm trying to understand is we have this large narrative and entrepreneurship or business or work of if you're out working the person next to you, you're going to be successful at the cost of your personal life or at the cost of your relationships or your hobbies or whatever it might be. And I've noticed this, especially as like I'm going to put in quotes aged. I know I'm still relatively young, but you know, I don't have the same bandwidth as I did in my 20s when I started the company. I'm trying to figure out, is that a truth or is that just a narrative of can we be successful while still also maintaining a balance? And that also not come with a stigma of you're not working hard enough as well. The only way that you deserve to be successful is because you put in 12-hour days, 6 days a week. I think it's an important question for entrepreneurs, but I also think it's an important question for, you know, anybody in a management position to when they're looking at their employees as well, as how much push is good push and how do we push for efficiency relative to just total time. And I think this really stems back to if we look at assembly line metrics for what is the goal, is how much can a person produce in a certain amount of time. Now that we're in an economy now that's based off of knowledge, right? It's a very difficult thing to measure of how is somebody being effective or not. And the only thing that we have is like, how long are they working? Are they working long enough or hard enough? So I don't know if that's the answer to your question or not, but that's something that I've been trying to figure out for myself and for my company.
Well, thank you so much for sitting and talking to us. This, like you said at the beginning, this was way out of our wheelhouse and it was still super entertaining and educational.
No, I really enjoyed it. Hopefully you guys learned something. I had a lot of fun doing it. And yeah, hopefully your listeners liked it as well. And if they want to reach out with more questions, happy to answer.
So moving on to this week in space flight history, we don't have any winners. We do have one loser, which is Dennis. So why are you a loser for this week in space flight history?
Yeah, so I messed up the clue. I picked a good event. Well, I do have a little bit of a defense to it, but in any event, let me just start off by saying what this week in space flight history's event was. It was the 30th of April, 1999, and it was when a Centaur upper stage wound up stranding the military satellite USA 143 on orbit, put in a useless orbit, not where it was intended to go. However, that's for reasons that'll become clear. I'd rather start by talking about an event on the 9th of April, 1999, and that is when a Titan 4B in the 402 configuration took a different satellite to orbit, a different government military one, USA 142, which was a DSP satellite, which stands for the defense support program. So this was a basically kind of a early warning, ICBMs are coming, you know, monitoring type of satellite. And so this Titan 4B in the 402 was supposed to take this to GEO. 402 in this context means that it has an inertial upper stage as its upper stage, the IUS. Classic storied two-stage solid rocket vehicle. They put these on expendable rockets. A bunch of them flew on early shuttles, sometimes taking satellites to GEO. Modified one took, I think it was Ulysses, you know, if you wanted to go interplanetary on a shuttle mission, this was a good way to give you some extra push. That modified one needed yet another upper stage. But in any event, this payload, USA-142, did not make it to GEO because the upper stage screwed up within 21 days of this week in spaceflight history. And so this is ultimately where my mistake came from. But the reason why the IUS did not stage correctly was that some thermal tape that was used on it's called a connector plug housing. So I haven't been able to find any kind of blueprints or anything, but the upshot is that there is a flange, and at some point this thermal tape wrapped around the IUS, where it's connected still to the, you know, rest of the rocket, needs to give you enough clearance to be able to, you know, basically do your staging and launch your, or fire your stage separation mechanism and then push them apart, whether it's, you know, bolts or whatever's going on. But one way or another, they're kind of mechanically clamped together and then they kind of get released. And so the instructions for applying this thermal tape for the technicians on the ground was that the tape should be applied, quote, within 0.5 inches of the mounting bracket flange. Okay? So that was the language that the technicians were working with.
It sounds unambiguous to me.
It sounds unambiguous, and I was going to say, my engineering chops, as bad as they are, I do understand, you know, math symbols like greater than, less than, equal to, things like that. And so that within 0.5 inches includes less than 0.5 inches, right? But what it should have been was no closer than 0.5 inches.
So it is unambiguous, but just in the wrong direction.
In the wrong direction, darn. Yes. Yeah. So unless they were literally at that 0.5 inches, it was wrong. And so the technicians reading at face value within 0.5 inches were like, okay, well, let's just tape it as tightly as we possibly can. And that's what they did. And they did it for 7 flights. And every time, you know, the jostling and bouncing around of spaceflight, of ascent, was enough to essentially jostle the tape loose enough that the separation mechanism could properly do its job and the IUS would actually, you know, would stage correctly. Yeah, and so just to clarify, right, where this taping too tightly happened, it was within the IUS, right, which I said was a two-stage, you know, solid. And so it's this upper stage of the IUS failing to separate from the bottom stage. And Ben found a great picture that shows that basically it was, you know, still kind of clung a little too tight on one side, and so it kind of more like semi-separated, and so it's just a whole big mess. But one way or another, could not get to the right orbit as a result.
I mean, it really just looks like a quick disconnect that you would use for, like, some garden hoses. Instead of screwing together, they have a collar that you pull back, and it will latch on or release the other half of the hose. Like, it really just looks like that with thermal tape wrapped around it to keep it insulated, and it's just how close it gets to that collar. I don't think that's actually a collar that moves up and down, but like it really is an innocuous error.
But on this particular one, in early of April 1999, on this Titan 4, the IUS, the tape was just too tight. Those technicians did too good a job, and the stage did not separate, and this payload, which was supposed to go to GEO, was left stranded in a useless LEO orbit, and that was that. It still is there, along with some pieces of debris, and so you can potentially, if the conditions are right, I went and checked it out on Heavens Above, and it does reach about magnitude 4 or 5, again, when the conditions are just right, and so it's not an easy thing to see overhead. So now that's where the clue came from, tape too tightly. It's pretty straightforward. What my mistake was underestimating just how much of a failure this rocket was in 1999. Because on the 30th of April, 1999, a Titan 4B in the 401 configuration, which means it has a Centaur upper stage, not an IUS, was supposed to take Milstar 3 or USA 143 to GEO. Milstar 3s, I hadn't heard about these before. It is a fascinating looking spy, you know, or I don't know, spy defense satellite. I don't know how else to, like, I don't really want to go through the whole rigmarole of trying to describe it, but basically I recommend checking out Milstar 3, M-I-L-S-T-A-R 3. It looks like a weird Lego piece, much larger than I think anything on orbit has any business being, but it's a weird one. But in any event, once again, 21 days after this, you know, tape too tightly event, the Centaur in this upper stage screwed up its insertion burns and left Milstar 3, USA 143, stranded in a low Earth orbit when it was supposed to go to GEO. So that's where I screwed up, basically. I underestimated just how many upper stages could fail to place a USA 140 blank to GEO within 22 days of each other. And so, mea culpa. I mean, I should have double-checked that, but I hope you could understand where the conflation can find its way in. So, be more careful in the future.
I mean, it's understandable. Yeah, because you're right. That's a crazy... I mean, what are the chances?
Well, I was going to say, I've got a third act surprise, I'll tell you. But I'll wait until I talk about this mission before I bring that one in. So... this is actually, I think, a very interesting event, and that's why I wish I had a good clue for it. And so, what happened? Well, just touch base, right? The Centaur had to do three burns, essentially, to get you to GEO, right? Its first burn was the put you in a parking orbit in LEO. The second burn was to raise the apogee to be at GEO, right? Put you on a transfer trajectory. And then the third burn, fire in the same direction, to circularize and bring your perigee up to GEO, and then you wind up in GEO. When you look at some sources, it might just say something like a programming error basically screwed it up and made it lose altitude control. But there is a fascinating amount of stuff going on under the hood. And so I was able to find this report essentially detailing the issue, and there's so much more to it than I even am able to go through here. And so if you think this is interesting or you really like to kind of go deep into this, go check out this this link. It'll be in the show notes. So how did this programming error basically doom USA 143? Well, it turns out that there are these filter constants that they put into the flight software. And one of them is the roll rate filter constant. So basically, as I can tell, it's this value that's designed to keep your flight control software to want to overcorrect in terms of the roll rate. Because it's got this big, like I kind of alluded to, these Milstar satellites are quite large. And so there's going to be fuel sloshing to some extent. There's going to be torques and, I guess, moments that they're exerting on the Centaur. And so you want to not have it respond, you know, 100% gung-ho to any kind of nudging that it gets. And so this has to be kind of written into a flight tape software that's then loaded into the rocket. And so this roll rate filter constant in particular should have had the numeric value -1.992476, and instead it got -0.1992476. So the decimal place was over by one. That was it. It was manually entered by somebody on the ground. They missed where the decimal place should have been, and thus this value had was off by a factor of 10. This is making me think of that one, what was it, that one Mariner that had the R instead of R dot, and it wound up wanting to, you know, spin upside down or do something kooky. But my goodness. So this mistake, right, so at least the value being off by a factor of 10, did appear in the, you know, the launch processing and, you know, process. And even during countdown, people had been seeing that. But people didn't realize that it was wrong. So there was a number of, like, all the kind of built-in redundancies and checks just kept failing one after the other. So apparently the control dynamics team, someone saw this number and was like, well, this seems awfully small compared to what it's been on previous flights. And so they tried to call their supervisor, but their supervisor wasn't around. And then, you know, was out of the office over the weekend. And then when they came back, they tried to call their supervisor, but their supervisor was on vacation or something. Like, there's all this bizarre, like, you know, people missing each other. And at the end of the day, they finally kind of all get on the same wavelength. And they're just like, yeah, it probably just, it's a different mission. Different missions will have different numbers to it. That's not a problem. Okay. So it defeated that kind of check. Then there was the, a product integrity engineer who saw it. And he's like, okay, well, maybe this is wrong, or maybe they were just testing everything in general. So they're like, okay, well, let's just do some tests of the gyros and see if they correctly, you know, identify the Earth's rotation. And so they did, and the gyros seemed fine. But it turns out that that test defaulted back to the kind of the default constants that show up. These constants for kind of filtering out the roll, pitch, and yaw rates. Because of it, it wasn't using this value that was off by a factor of 10, so of course it was going to perform just fine. And then another engineer somewhere else down the line saw it and just didn't have any context and was like, yeah, I guess that number looks fine for me, right? I mean, David and Ben, if I told you that number should have been 50, like, would you have had any knowledge that it should be something else? Like, okay,
I mean,
whatever.
Come on, it's obvious. Just a number. Why? No. This is an obvious mistake. Even without context, like, you should. No, I'm just kidding.
Rate filter less than, you know, or with a magnitude less than one? Come on.
I mean, yeah. Anytime you have a filter, the numbers can change so drastically from one application to another. Even if you know exactly which filter it is, I suspect you would be hard pressed to know what that was wrong just looking at it. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what was very disappointing is that the people who did see that they were like, well, this is 10 times less than it had been on the previous N many flights. So maybe we should look into this. And they still ended up concluding that it wasn't an issue. So, what is having this value being so small mean? The upshot is that it basically zeros any roll rate data. So they lost entire roll authority. Once the Centaur was up there, it just could not control the roll rate whatsoever. During the first burn, the first one to put it into a parking orbit, it starts kind of rolling back and forth. It's not being able to correct for things correctly because it has this value that's off by a factor of 10. Fuel begins to slosh. That creates an oscillation that kind of makes things even worse. And then eventually trying to control for yaw and pitch starts to fail as it starts rolling more and more. And then they lose yaw and pitch, and then the whole thing is tumbling. The flight control software gets confused and upset by all this tumbling and sloshing around and shuts down early. And so they still, I guess, manage to limp into a parking orbit. But at this point, they're now on their first coast phase, waiting until they get to the right, longitude to be able to then fire their first, or I guess their second burn, and try to, you know, get to their transfer orbit to Geo. But just during this first coast phase, right, like I said, they've been tumbling even when the first burn shut down. So they then, while still in parking orbit, before the second burn, managed to get the vehicle under control, or at least get its yaw and pitch under control, because they can't control the roll anymore. And so, but to do that, they had to burn through 85% of the hydrazine on the Centaur. So they're down to only 15%, and they're still in Leo. They have a long ways to go, and they still can't control roll. And so then comes time for the second burn. The second burn is a longer burn, so things are even worse. This time, the yaw and pitch controls get saturated, and 2 minutes after the burn, it's tumbling again, and it's just a big mess. I assume it shuts down earlier, but one way or another, it's now on some other janky trajectory that it wasn't intending to be on. And now it's doing its second coast, right? So its transfer orbit, which I'll just give you kind of the heads up, it's still in Leo. It still wants to, minimize this tumbling. And during the second coast, it burns through that remaining 15% hydrazine. Maybe some of it went through during the second burn as well. And so the upshot is that when it's ready to go and circularize its orbit, it's this tumbling mess. It has no hydrazine, so you know, what the hell? So it's literally just like when you've lost control in Kerbal and your rocket is just tumbling around and your engine's firing, you're just like, whatever, screw it. And so this third burn, you know, started earlier than it should have. It burned shorter than they wanted to, but it didn't matter. It was spinning in every which direction. And at the end of the day, instead of ending up in Geo, it wound up in a 549 by 3,347 mile orbit. So Leo, eccentric enough to kind of dip out into, you know, above Leo, this kind of no man's land, I guess, between Leo and Mio. And yeah, so this was just a big mess, essentially. But yeah, I love that we learned this report exactly what happened when you had this, you know, upper stage, this rocket that could not control itself or roll at all, and yet still went through all three firings. At this point, the ground made contact with the satellite, which was damaged. You know, it was definitely getting jostled around a lot worse than it was supposed to. And so, but it was, you know, in good enough condition that they could communicate with it. Nothing could be done. These Milstar 3s are no good in LEO. And in any event, I couldn't find, you know, USA 143 in the, you know, in at least Heavens Above's satellite database. It's not the easiest thing to search for. Maybe it was still up there, or maybe, you know, this being 25 years ago, you know, having a perigee of 549 miles meant that it's deorbited in the meantime entirely. So this was an $800 million failure with $433 million in launch costs. Yeah, it was, I kind of described how it basically managed to evade a bunch of sets of redundancy. And this paper, I liked it. It did have one line where it pointed out that, you know, sometimes built-in redundancy can cause complacency and overconfidence, since the redundancy here, in this particular case, was ineffective. And so if you're going to build in redundancies, you really want to make sure that they will work. And thinking of you, Ben, this is an example of a failure while performing as built/programmed, right? So sometimes, you know, it doesn't do what you intended it to do. But why is that? Because of some unforeseen outside thing. But here, they basically set it up wrong. And so it did what it was supposed to do, which was not what it was supposed to do.
Yeah. But computers do exactly what you tell them to do, even if you tell them to do the wrong thing.
Yep. And so as for that surprise I kind of want to give you, this is pretty ridiculous, right? Having two failures, you know, within a month of each other in the spring of 1999. I'll give you a guess at what happened with a Titan IV in the summer of 1998, the launch before the IUS was taped too tight. It had another failure. Enroll 7. And this was another Centaur 1. Without going into too much detail, it looks like that there was some issue with a frayed wire, and so the guidance system short-circuited at T plus 40 seconds. They lost control, and range safety terminated the vehicle. So this is a serious string of losses there for the old Titan IV, which I've heard about, you know, the infamous Titans referred to, like, I've heard people refer to them, like, as infamous, the Titan IV in particular. And that, I think they're specifically talking about this back-to-back-to-back, a hat trick of catastrophic failures. But yeah, in any event, again, I apologize about conflating them, but I hope you can kind of see why. The hits just kept on coming for this particular launch vehicle. So in any event, that was this week in spaceflight history.
Thank you, Dennis. Bringing two spaceflight failures in one to WSIF is absolutely a win in my book. Like, I wouldn't have had you fail any other way. It was fantastic.
Thank you.
All right. So next week is going to be the 7th through the 18th of May. David, do you have a clue for us?
Yes, I do. The clue is for next week in 1963, not a good day for trypanophobics.
All right. If you have a guess as to what this horrible clue is referencing, email us at info@theurbanmechanics.com or shoot us a toot on Mastodon. Use the hashtag ThisWeekSF. Or you can also visit theurbanmechanics.com/Discord for an invite to our Discord server. Good luck.
All right. So let's do upcoming spaceflight events. And thank you to Launch Library 2, which is where we start our research each week. And we have 6 events. I think 4 or 5 of them launches. So mostly launches. And what's the first one?
All right. First up is a Falcon 9 Block 5 launching Worldview Legion 1 and 2. We mentioned this last week. These are Maxar built and operated Earth observation satellites going into polar orbits now, and then in the future, they're going to go to mid-inclination orbits. I believe I've got that the right way around. This is going to be launching on Wednesday, May 1st, in a window coming from a marine navigation warning. So that window is 1830 UTC to 1924 UTC out of Vandenberg.
And next up, we got a little space station shuffling. This was, I guess, last week we said this was scheduled for April 30th, but it's been pushed back. NASA TV will have coverage of the relocation of SpaceX Crew 8 space vehicle, basically going from forward to zenith of Harmony. And so that's always neat to go and take a little trip around the station. to clear things up. And so in any event, NASA TV coverage will begin at 7:30 a.m. Eastern, with the undocking scheduled for 7:45 a.m. and redocking 8:28 a.m. So it looks like a little over, you know, a little under 45 minutes.
And then after that, on the 2nd, we have a Starlink launch. And this is for Starlink Group 655. And of course, that's on another Falcon 9 Block 5, launching from Slick 40 at the Cape. And the window for that is 0143 UTC through 0614 UTC. So, yep, there's your Starlink for the week, at least one. Or no, I think we got another one.
After that is a Long March 5 launching Chang'e 6. Really cool, man. China is absolutely dominating the moon these days. Just so much science happening. It's fantastic. And Chang'e 6 is pretty cool. It's got international science instruments coming from France, Italy, Sweden, and Pakistan. And I don't know if that's happened on a Chang'e flight before. So that's headed to the far side of the moon on Friday, May 3rd, between 0700 hours UTC and 01300 hours UTC. Again, this is coming from a NOTAM. So that's the best window we got.
And then next, we've got our second Starlink of the week. Seems like it's been a slow week for Starlinks. Only two. so yeah, this will be a Falcon 9 taking Starlink Group 8-2 to LEO. This also is coming pair NOTAMs. So the window is Saturday, May 4th at 0259 to 0730 UTC. And this one will be launching out of Vandenberg Space Force Base at Space Launch Complex 4E.
And then after that, on the 7th, we have an Atlas V, and this is launching CST-100. So this is the Starliner crew test flight, taking Butch Wilmer and Suni Williams to the ISS. So this is going to be kind of cool. And so I don't see any coverage here on NASA TV on the website. I assume it will be covered, right?
It's got to be.
Yeah,
I was going to make a joke about how, oh no, it's they're not going to have any coverage of it live whatsoever.
Yeah, but yeah, so assuming that lifts off at the right time, that time will be on the 7th, launching from Space Launch Complex 41, and the launch time will be 0234 UTC. So pretty early in the morning or late at night. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm going to try to watch that because that'll be cool. So looking forward to it.
It's a big deal.
All right. Those are your upcoming spaceflight events.
All right, which means it's time to deal with the show, and we would like to thank Ron Jenkins and Tim Dodd for our music.
For more information on this episode, such as show notes and other links, visit our website at theorbitalmechanics.com.
We record live on Sundays at 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 p.m. Eastern. Thank you so much to Dennis O., Mr. Cesium, Mike, Colin, Chris S., Delta V, and The Greek for joining our recording session today and helping us make correction burns on the fly.
And if you want to support the show, please tell a friend or better yet, leave us a review wherever you listen. You can also visit theorbitalmechanics.com/support for our Patreon campaign. And affiliate links.
Get in touch. Find links to our mailing list, Discord server, and Mastodon account at theorbitalmechanics.com/about, where you can skip all of that by emailing info@theorbitalmechanics.com.
So that's it. We will see you all next week on Orbit. Until then, later.
Goodbye, everybody.
See you.